Safety, dependability, and power. Chevy Silverado isn't happy unless the work is hard and the day is long. No wonder Silverado is America's number one best-selling retail pickup truck. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I'm not going to complain.
Here's John Williams.
I'll take what I can get when I can get it. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Thanks for tuning in. We're here today until 3. Steve Bertrand said, hey, that Missing Rascals podcast we recorded about an hour ago is a pretty good one. You be the judge. We'll post it about 5 o'clock this evening, and I'll see what you think. We'll always take your questions, comments, and observations about the Missing Rascals. Just email me. I'm John Williams at WGNRadio.com, and we'll include some of your thoughts in the podcast if you want to communicate with us that way. On the stream yesterday, White Sox baseball was on the radio, so we did our whole show yesterday. Did you catch us at WGNRadio.com? Maybe you didn't. On the stream yesterday, we talked to Jim Donovan of Clarendon Hills. You can hear our full conversation with him at WGNRadio.com on the John Williams page. Jim Donovan's son, Joe, is the catcher for Michigan. And Michigan lost in the final game of the College World Series last night, 8-2 to Vanderbilt. Michigan's hitting wasn't as good as Vandy's pitching. Wolverines struck out 14 times. But what a run for the Big Ten team that did not win the conference or the conference tournament and whose at-large bid to get into the tournament was, said Jim, in doubt. But they got in, and they beat everyone along the way, including number one ranked UCLA to get to the finals. Joe Donovan hit a big home run in that game against UCLA. We watched last night the final game of the College World Series and saw Joe with that mop of blonde hair and the white headband he has to hold it back. That headband is in honor of his older brother, Charlie, who was also drafted by Michigan to play shortstop. Charlie would be a senior on that team this year, but tragically, suddenly, he died at the age of 18 after he was offered a scholarship. The details of his death aren't important here. His father told us yesterday on the stream that litigation will keep him from talking about it, but Michigan continued to honor him for the 4 years that he would have been there, including giving his parents a framed jersey on senior day. When Charlie died, white ribbons went up all around his neighborhood. Those white headbands Joe wears honor that. So for the Donovans, last night in this whole tournament have been bittersweet. Their son Joe had the ride of his life, and at every turn, they would think of Charlie. Had he lived and not turned pro, would have been playing shortstop, playing along with his brother. Joe told us the story yesterday of what happened after one of those games, by the way. Michigan had won, and afterwards, the son Joe walks down the right field line to where the parents are to hug his mom and dad after the game. And there, a man with his young son approached the father, Jim, and asked if they could get an autograph from his son. He said, sure. Joe, the strapping catcher, looks down at the little boy and says, what's your name? And the boy says, Charlie. He said, what position do you play? And he said, shortstop. The father told us that they get signs like this all the time, Charlie, that he is still with them. Better that he'd be there in person, better that Michigan have won, but lacking that, they take some real comfort in still feeling his presence. His father tells a remarkable story to us, full of smiles and tears, in the segment that you can hear on our website at WGNRadio.com on the John Williams page. And I didn't know any of that until yesterday, and a friend of a friend said, you ought to talk a little bit about the Donovan kid on Michigan, and then the father told us some remarkable things. So that's on our webpage at WGNRadio.com on the John Williams page. I saw my sister last night, and she was fiddling with her phone, and I said, well, what are you looking at? And she said, well, I'm following Chris. That's her son, my nephew. I said, well, what are you doing? She says, well, we have this app called Life 360, and it enables you to connect with your kids, and you can see where they are at all times. And I didn't know about this. I'm half glad that I didn't have it when my kids were young teenagers. But since kids and their phones are inseparable, wherever the phone goes, you can find it. So her son's away at camp, and she's able to tell where he is at camp. I mean, with like GPS accuracy, right? So is he in his dorm room where they're staying at camp, or is he in the cafeteria? Is he in one of the classrooms or out on the playing field? She kind of knows what he's doing at all times. In fact, she sort of made a face, and I said, what's the matter? And she says, oh, I think he's missing dinner. And I said, how do you know? And she says, well, he's still in his room, and dinner ends at 7 o'clock, and I don't think he's going to be at dinner in time, something like that.
Oh, my.
And so then she texts him, you know, and they have this exchange. And I said to my wife on the way home, I said, do you think Mary's a helicopter parent? And she said, no, Mary's not. You know, she's just kind of...
What's closer than a helicopter parent?
No, but she's not. So this story doesn't fully represent her or them. But
oh, I mean, see.
But I think it's especially nice when your son's away for the first time at camp and you hope he's getting along. You know, you're not supposed to pick up the phone and call him and all of that jazz.
Well, so how close does it get? Because I actually tracked my daughter, Emma. Not that I asked. I don't know how it got set up one time, but we did, and she... I mean, I don't.
You
look
still
at it.
Do?
Well, it's on my phone. I haven't looked. Let's see.
You
where
could
she
pick
is.
Up your phone and let's see where she is right now.
Yeah, I could.
How do you spell helicopter, Steve?
No, but I did. It wasn't my idea. It was hers. And
hers.
She would track us, and so when we were going to visit her at school, you know, she would get a kick out of sort of walking out of her house just as we were pulling up to the house. You know, because she was following us that way.
But you know, it would be just as valuable for the kids because if mom and dad are coming, oh my God, they're here! Quick. Hide the drugs.
Right.
You know, get the boy out the back window. Whatever your thing is that you don't want your parents to see, just quick. They're 100 feet away. You could know that with to-the-foot accuracy.
She's on Beverly Boulevard.
Oh, my gosh.
Looks like it might be her office.
Okay, so maybe she's sitting there at work.
She's right across from the Petty Cash and Taqueria and Bar.
It's got that all laid out there.
Yeah.
Are you looking at a map or satellite?
It's a map, you know. I don't have the pictures. It's got the words of what's there.
This app that my sister has, Life 360, has a satellite view. It's like one of those real estate things or the map view, but you can see exactly where they are. And then when they move, there they go. In fact, and it traces their day. So, for instance, she'll say, well, I know that one of her kids took a trip. And she says, well, I could tell that Rachel landed here. There's the airport. And then here's the trip they took in the car to get to the place where they were going to be. And you see the route. And then you see where she walked. And it's amazing what you can know. And Brenda and I are looking at this going, that's really awesome. We're kind of glad we didn't have that. Because say your kid's in college. You could tell if they're at the bars at 3 in the morning. And maybe you don't want to know that. Well, one of the great things about your kids, if they ever go away to college, one of the great things is, A, you don't see that room of theirs that way, and their laundry all the time, and B, you can't worry anymore about their coming and going because you don't know. Unless you have this app, and then you can sit there and go, it's 2:30 in the morning, and they're still not in their dorm. And then you get to stress out all over again about that, even more so. So to me, it's not perfect. It's not a perfect thing. You know, in the tragic instances where a young person goes missing, if they do have their phone, and sometimes if they're captured by somebody, the first thing they do is destroy or throw away the phone. But I mean, you would know where the phone is, at least, and if it's attached to the person, then you'd be able to find them. I'm not thinking about that so much as I'm just thinking of the pros and cons of an app like that.
Well, that's why they say ignorance is bliss.
Totally. Totally. I mean, as long as, say your kid has it in college, you know, as long as they're going to go to classes and graduate someday, and most kids do, there's going to be stupid stuff in between and bad decisions, but you don't have to be part of that. You don't even have to know about that, you know? So I'm not sure I love that app. Similarly, if the husband had it and the wife had it, I guess you all could know where each other is. Do you know where Sharon is right now, Steve? You probably do.
Oh, no. No.
Because say you're at a bar and you should be home, you know, helping do the thing that we're going to do because your parents are coming over tomorrow and I don't need you having a drink with the boys after work. Your wife could see that. Or you're at a casino or you're at the ball, wherever you're not supposed to be. You're at your girlfriend's house. The spouses could know about that. it could be very helpful because, hey, you're the jewel. I'll ring you up and I'll shoot you a text. You can pick up some milk. That's the good version of it.
But
the bad versions are there too.
Well, I mean, you got to be alone once in a while. I mean, even so, we have alerts set up on our phones for charges, you know, if it's charge in excess of something or if it's a gas station charge. So if I get an alert that I know there was a, you know, a
use of the credit card, you mean?
Use of the credit card at a gas station, or let's say she bought something that was over $150.
Right.
You know, I'm not even going to bring it up.
But that's from your credit card, not from the app.
Yeah, right. But I'm saying it's not like it's like you're being monitored all the time. You know, if I were to send a text, oh, I see you spent $172.13 at Costco today. You know, that's bad. That's not a good thing.
But I want to be clear about this. You are or aren't getting those notices.
Well, I get generally because of our credit card.
But then for
fraud, we get notices when there's a spending, I think it's over $200.
Okay, so if your daughter does that, you'll get a notice.
No, if Sharon does that.
What? Okay, well, no, that's fine.
We share a credit card.
Okay, yeah.
So we're both set up on the fraud notices.
Yeah, right.
But if I were to get that notice and say, oh, hey, I see you were at Target today or
right.
something.
Well.
That's just... You get that whole monitored feeling. I don't think that's a good thing.
Okay, 312-981-7200. I'm just wondering what your experience is with these kind of apps. I have none of this. This is all alien to me. Whatever your simple truths are, it's fiction to me. I'd just like to hear how that goes. 312-981-7200. Call or text right now. So I just heard about this Life360 app. A lot of calls and texts about this. John, of course you lose your privacy. However, with my family, no worries. That's life. John, my kids and I have it, and it's nice when we're traveling, especially if we're hiking in the desert or the mountains. John, I do not like the idea of someone being able to stalk someone else. John, I'm 81 years old, and two of my sons know where I am. I've told them, if I don't move in a few days, check me out. It's safety for an old woman. Yeah, if your mom, if grandma had this, you'd know where, if she keeps her phone handy and on and charged, grandma, we'd know if you're moving or not. Another one says, hey, it's helpful for elderly with slight memory issues so the family knows where they are. John, we use Life360. We use it with our kids. Our daughter specifically hates it. We love it. We know where they're at all times. We know how fast they're going. The app shows if they're using their phone, if they're braking too hard, accelerating too fast. Yes, Big Brother is watching. Hey, Mike, you're on WGN. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Hey, love the show.
Thank you, sir.
But I'm really glad when my kids went to college.
Yeah.
They've been out about 15 years now, and I'm just now starting to enjoy the stories they're telling me about what they did when they were in college. I wouldn't have wanted to know.
And you don't even want to know, like, after they survive them. And you're right. There's like a... Attention, people who are 20. Do not tell these stories until you are 30. We don't want to hear them yet.
Exactly. They're in their mid-30s now, and they tell me these stories, and we all laugh. But I'm glad I didn't know at the time.
Man, thanks for the call. Glad you're listening, and good job, Dad. Nadine, you're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Hi, John. I was calling about the comment on, like, email notifications from a debit card charge.
Yeah.
My husband and I both have our, you know, I get the email alerts whenever I've gone to the gas station or he goes to the store. But I think it's very important that you have an idea of what's being charged, even if it's a small amount. I got an alert that charge on my husband's car was made at Hot Topic, and I quickly texted him. I said, "Are you buying like emo shirts and, you know, like weird stuff from this website or the store?" Because he doesn't even know what Hot Topic was. He said no. So I contacted my bank and disputed the $50 charge because someone hacked his card.
Wow.
And would have been up $50 if I didn't get that, like, something that looked really weird and unusual. I'm like, did you do this? And he says no. And I'm like, yeah, I better dispute that and get the card changed.
You know, the one thing I don't like about the Nadina is if I'm trying to buy something for Brenda for a gift, say Christmas time, and I'm at Nordstrom, and I go, oh, she'll like this cologne. I'll get her this cologne. If I don't have $100 in cash, and sometimes I'm buying her something that I don't have the cash for, and even if I'm withdrawing cash, she'll go, why did you take $300 out? That might come up. But, I mean, if you can't use your credit card then if you want to surprise somebody because they'll know it's on the bill, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like buying flowers. I would see the charge on the checking account, and I'm like, oh, I'm getting flowers.
And Brenda will sometimes know before she even gets the dang flowers. What are you thinking, Mr. Bertrand?
Well, don't you think that's worth the trade, though, because someone took your card and started using it? Or, I mean, I've had that happen.
Yeah, versus it's hard to surprise your wife with flowers.
Right. Like, I can't buy anything for Sharon on Amazon Prime because it's linked to her email.
Well, I want both. I'd like to have my flowers and eat them, too.
Well, I've just stopped giving gifts.
Nadine, thank you for the call. There it is. Thank you, Steve. 139 WGN, John Williams here. How are you? Nice to have you aboard. Rich Lenkoff's the attorney that does that Legal Face-Off podcast. He visits with us once in a while. In the next half hour, Rich joins us to talk about when you can or can't sue a baseball team. More people getting hit in the stands at baseball games. I've long said that whatever that back of that ticket says, I don't care. There should be some liability there, and of course that leads to putting up the nets around the ballparks. We're going to just talk about the legal ramifications there a little after two, especially after we discovered more about that little girl who was hit by the Robert Almora, the Almora line drive. But that, what you just heard, I talked too long, was the theme from a new TV show called City on a Hill. I was reading about this in the Sun-Times the other day, and Brenda and I have been watching it, really enjoying it. It's on Showtime on Sundays. It's set in Boston. It takes place in the 90s. It looks forward, though. A lot of the issues seem very contemporary, although you can tell that it's a show set in the maybe early 90s because they're still smoking a lot. But it's a really good show for a lot of reasons. One of them is because Kevin Bacon is on it, and I think a lot of us are big Kevin Bacon fans, particularly when he plays against his type. He's a smarmy bad guy with a good heart, or a smarmy good guy with a bad heart. But he's one of those cops that plays it both ways. And another guy on this show who you'll recognize is Aldis Hodge, who you have seen in Straight Outta Compton, in a number of TV series, both as a small part and as a starring role. You've seen him in commercials. He's been a model. In fact, his wiki is one of those things that make you think after you read it, I don't think I'm going to like him. It's too good. Hey, Aldis, this is John. Are you there?
What's happening? Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. We're good?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Do you hear that nice introduction I gave you?
Yes, indeed. I heard it all, man. I appreciate it.
That's quite a resume. I mean, like, I didn't even get to finish it, but I just wanted to ask you about a couple of details here before we talk about the show, okay?
Sure.
So, actor. I've seen you in episodes of Friday Night Lights, Walking Dead, stuff
right.
like that.
Right.
You were in Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah.
You were in Hidden Figures.
Yeah, good old Hidden Figures. That was fantastic.
Yeah, no kidding. Underground.
Yeah, Underground.
That's the WGN series. And then this new series. You've been a male model. I guess you're not a female, so I guess male is not necessary. You've been a model.
where did you get that fact? Who said male model? Uh-oh. Yeah, man. Yeah, I used to model back in the day.
When
I was a kid.
Were you on Sesame Street as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Back in, man, Big Bird was my homie. Mm-hmm.
Not many people
can
say
brother,
that.
My brother Edwin and Edwin Hodge, she's an actor as well. Yeah, Edwin and I both were on Sesame Street together.
You know, you never know, because you see people like on a show when they're a child, and you think, oh, this is working for them. Like, you were in one of the early Diehards, too, right?
Yeah, I managed to sneak in two different Diehards, but the first one that I was in, Die Hard with Vengeance, that's arguably the best one, just saying.
But, I mean, you never know if those careers are going to pan out for those people, if they'll really have the chops down the road, and it's right. sure worked out for you. And then, do I read correctly, you were in Showboat on Broadway?
Yes, again, with my brother Edwin Hines. Also, my brother Edwin was in Die Hard alongside me. But we did Showboat on Broadway. That was a fantastic experience as well, man. It taught us the foundation of acting and how we sort of managed to get to that point. When I was shooting Die Hard, Sam Jackson told my mom, if you want your boys to learn the true foundation of acting, get them on stage. So then coincidentally enough, we had an audition for this play and didn't realize what it was or the magnitude of it. But, you know, the universe works for you in all kinds of ways. You just got to, you know, prick up your ears and listen.
So you're able to sing, too?
Nah, brother, that's back in the day. I don't know if the vocals are really hitting right now. You know what I mean? Hey, a little rusty, brother. A little rusty. I'm not about to bust out no notes.
So you dropped an octave, and maybe you don't have the singing chops you did once upon a
time.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's, and then just one other thing here. It says you're a painter, that you're an artist,
yes,
and that you're also a micro-mechanical engineer. Now, what the hell is that?
Exactly what it sounds like. I work on micro machines. I'm a watchmaker and a watch designer. So that's my other profession outside of entertainment. I've been designing timepieces since I was like 19 years old. So I turned it more into a serious profession when I decided to start my own brand a few years ago. And I've been plugging away ever since trying to develop my own pieces. It's not easy, but, you know, it's so well worth it.
I used to have a rock collection, but it all seems less important
I
now.
I used to have a rock collection, too, though.
Sure you
did. I still have a rock collection all over my house. I got nothing but rocks and stones and all that. I mean, they're my materials for watchmaking, but still, I got them. So I still collect, brother. Still collect.
So then talk to me about this series. We were just kind of talking amongst ourselves while we were reconnecting with you how fun it is to see this smarmy Kevin Bacon character playing off of you and you playing off of him. Talk about City on a Hill for a minute.
Yeah, man. City on the Hill back in Boston in the 90s. We are set in 1992 when we began the show. But, you know, it's one of those just raw, gritty crime dramas we haven't seen in a long time. And the beautiful thing about their perspective on it, which I love, is that there's duality to everybody, good and bad, right? And even with the criminals, we realize these criminals are doing something that they feel is a decision they can get behind. I'm trying to feed my family. I'm trying to make sure my kids are good, so I'm going to do what I have to do, right? My character, DeCourcy Ward, comes to town. He's from Brooklyn originally, comes to Boston to shake things up and really try to put his stamp on justice. But he learns quickly through Kevin Bacon's character that Boston plays by very different, dirty rules. So he has to kind of get with the program. And for him, he's trying to figure out how to play their game, but by his own rules, so he can still look in the mirror and recognize the guy he's staring at the end of the day. But it becomes progressively harder dealing with the Boston politics and, you know, not realizing who the criminal is. Is it the guy wearing the badge or is it the guy holding the illegal gun? We don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those things, too, where you wonder if your character is going to get corrupt and play the game, or if maybe your character is going to sort of make Kevin Bacon's character see the error of his ways and he's going to clean up his act a little bit. So you've got sort of this, I think, duality of the two characters, and maybe at the end of the day each will benefit or change a little as a result. But I'm rooting for you, and I told Brenda the other night, I don't know if I'm rooting for Kevin Bacon or not. I don't know if
Well, you hit the nail on the head, and that's sort of the fine razor's edge that we walk is, you know, my character, DeCourcy, his challenge that we'll see throughout and rather we'll explore throughout this season is how far is he willing to go? How corrupt is he willing to get to accomplish his end game goal, right? And this entire relationship between him and Jackie, Kevin's character, It's really, for me, it's a beautiful thing to watch because I'm so curious. I don't know when they like each other, if they like each other. I don't know if they're screwing each other over. I really don't know if they respect each other, if they're just using each other or not. Like, there's not one point where I can get really comfortable and I know what's going to happen between the two. That's why, personally, for me, they're fun to watch, and that's why I like playing it with Kevin, because we don't want people to really know. And those questions asked, we want people to ask those questions, because honestly, you won't really find out till we get to the end of the road.
We're talking about Showtime's City on a Hill with Aldis Hodge. He co-stars with Kevin Bacon in this series. What's Kevin Bacon like to work with, by the way?
He's fantastic to work with. Really, truly is, you know, scholar and a gentleman. He brings his A-game to set. He doesn't miss a beat. You know, he treats everybody with respect, and he's down to get the real work done to get the job right, you know. The very first time we met, we found that synergy. We hit it off, and we kind of knew that we were going to challenge each other. So, you know, just like our characters are two fighters in a ring, Kevin and I are two titans in a ring pushing each other's potential to that maximum when it comes to being in scenes together. Because, you know, the words that we're getting are gold. And much, you know, much thanks to the show's creator, Chuck McLean. He's fantastic. And then we have our showrunner, Tom Fontana, you know, creative eyes. He's got a wealth of knowledge and history on him. So we can't really go through, we can't go wrong with these guys. But, you know, I just try not to mess up what's right there in front of me, you know. But Kevin, he's awesome, man.
Is it tempting to go, hey, I know a guy who you to do the whole 7 degrees of separation with him? Have you done? Is that a fun? That's a good joke. I would definitely recommend that.
Yeah, but you know, I think what's funny is that, you know, Kevin is figured out how to use the popularity of the whole 6 degrees thing. He actually has a company called 6 degrees, which, you know, what happens is they go into different cities and they expose the beautiful work being done by different charities. So we, while in New York, in Manhattan, you know, he took me down there with 6 degrees to go check out this organization called The Door, and we shed a little light on them, give them a little TV exposure, a little, you know, I'm saying, a little media exposure, and that's what he does, you know. So he took 6 degrees and turned it into something great. So I can't help but respect that.
You know, I didn't know that the series that you're on, City on a Hill, is based on a true story. According to the Sun-Times story about you and this series the other day, it's inspired by true stories, including a 1996 event known as the Boston Miracle.
Homicide rates
dropped 63% when I guess they cracked down on guns in that city.
Yeah. So it's inspired by. We're not telling a fictional version of that in depth. We are telling our own original stories, but they are inspired by those elements. And what happened with The Boston Miracle was fantastic, and my character, DeCourcy, is inspired by a real DA. His name is Ralph C. Martin, who went to Boston, and he was a part of the whole thing, you know. And to shed a little light on that sort of community fellowship and town's leadership, where people can actually get together, the community leaders, the pastors, the teachers, the cops, and everybody works with one another to crack down on crime, and you see the result. Like you said, 63% is massive. So, you know, for us to be able to take some pieces of that and use it as inspiration for these characters' voices, I think is awesome. And it's partly why I signed on to the show as well, because I felt like there was real substance to what we were talking about here.
Yeah. You know, I wonder sometimes when an actor like you is in a script like that that's very real, and so there's coarse language, it's on Showtime, there's sex scenes, there's language that you couldn't say on network TV. Sometimes there's racial epithets hurled your way. And I wonder, as an African-American, I know it's acting and I know we're all doing our job here, but after the scene is cut, they say, good, cut. Do you guys, I wonder what the next breath is like for you all. Does the one guy kind of look sheepishly at you like, hey, man, I'm just doing my job here? Or am I inventing something in my head that isn't even an issue?
No, it's always an issue. Look, that word, primarily discussing the N-word here, it hurts every single time, right? But when it comes to the art, we know why we're doing it and why it needs to be used, and it's not used egregiously, it's used effectively in these points because you have to show the truth of the ugliness of racism when we're addressing it. You can't cover it up. That's just insulting, right, to the people that are targeted by racism. So when it comes to our actors, there's such a degree of respect that they handle these situations with. When we're doing rehearsals, nobody says these harsh words.
Really?
Only in time. Yeah. They skip that. They're like, I'm not going to say this elsewhere. Of course not. You got to realize this word is still killing people today, and it hasn't changed, you know. So they understand the gravity of it all, and they handle it with so much respect and poise that I really appreciate it because, you know, we do have black people on set that, regardless of whether it's a scene or not, they're still affected because when we leave set, we have to go into our daily lives and we're still affected by this. You know, I've had several encounters of racism this year alone in New York, but I did have an encounter where, late 20s, early 30s white male called me the N-word out in public, you know, while putting his hands on me. So, when we leave, the fantasy of what we're doing doesn't just stay there. You know what I mean? Because it's not fantasy.
Yeah.
And people know that these are part of our daily lives, so they do handle it with a great degree of respect, and I can really appreciate that.
Maybe
we do have a good set.
Maybe on the set, then, yeah, those words are more impactful, too, when they, you know, then that guy really is going to say it the one time, and then you're really going to feel it the one time, and there's a gritty realness to this show, and the way you all play off of each other is terrific. It's called City on a Hill. It's on Showtime on Sundays. Hey, it's nice to talk to you. I know you're in Chicago, and we didn't connect, but maybe the next time you're in town, we will. But keep up the good work.
I'd love to.
And thanks for giving us some of your time.
Absolutely, brother. I appreciate you taking the time.
Aldis Hodge on Showtime's City on a Hill.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
That's what I do.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't always work out. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio until 3. We think we recorded a pretty good session of The Mincing Rascals today. Listen for our award-winning podcast, judged by the Illinois Broadcasters Association, Best in Illinois this year. You can hear it. Today, we'll drop the latest episode around 5. In the fourth inning of a May 29th game between the Chicago Cubs and the Astros at Minute Maid Park, Albert Almora Jr. lined a foul ball into the seats past the Cubs' dugout along the third base line. The Cubs were in Houston playing the Astros, and the ball hit a girl there. She suffered a skull fracture, and now we understand brain injuries. Now, usually I ask about the liability of a case like this. Should the family sue or be able to sue? That issue, I believe, is soon to become moot because the teams are going to put up protective netting around the fields. But if they do sue for medical or pain or suffering or lost future income or just to motivate teams to do the right thing, I think I'm with them on this one, regardless of what the ticket says. Rich Lenkov is a Capital member at Bryce Downey & Lenkov. He's the host of the Legal Face-Off podcast that you regularly hear at WGNRadio.com, and he's in the studio. Hi, Rich. Welcome back.
Not award-winning. Not yet. Try to get there.
You'll have to get around us, fella. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely.
What do you make of my send-up of that thing?
Well, baseball, Major League Baseball, and the Cubs enjoy immunity
and the Astros
from such lawsuits and the Astros, and not just because of recent developments. This goes back over 100 years. This has been carved out specifically for baseball teams. No one else enjoys this kind of protection, so much so that it's called the baseball rule. And that basically means that you assume the risk as a spectator when you go to a baseball stadium of balls being thrown into the stands or ending up in the stands, and therefore you cannot successfully sue a baseball club for those injuries. Not only do you accept that risk, John, but the courts have held that you welcome that risk, right? By bringing your glove in, by trying to catch balls, fans not only know about it, but are welcoming that risk, and therefore they're immune from lawsuits.
What about if I'm on a Ferris wheel or a roller coaster at an amusement park and something goes wrong? I bought a ticket. There's language on that.
Yeah, different. Under those circumstances, as well as almost any other circumstance dealing with what we call premises liability, basically where you're injured because of the negligence of the owner of a property, in your example, the roller coaster, in those situations, the owner of the roller coaster will still allege that you have some contributory fault, but that's not absolute. You will be able to show that they were negligent in that they failed to properly train the owner of the roller or the operator of the roller coaster, for example, or that there was some defect. None of those arguments hold water when it comes to the baseball rule.
Okay, so even though they have disclaimer language when you buy a ticket at an amusement park, or if you rent a wave runner, or if you go out on the fancy boat that bounces around on the lake, and you sign a thing, and it goes, if you get injured, it's not on us, Bucky. It may be, in fact.
Exactly. I represent lots of those kind of companies, and I defend them. And even though if you go out on a wave runner, or I've represented a lot of amusement parks, bouncy house companies, I had a case recently where a woman got injured in a inflatable house, and she signed a waiver. The court, as they often will do, consider that contract what's called a contract of adhesion. What does that mean? It means that there's unequal bargaining power between the consumer and the owner. And to your point, because no one reads that anyway, the courts say, even though you sign that, we're not going to hold you to that standard. We're going to force the owner of the company to prove that you were aware of the risk. That doesn't apply to baseball.
Well, I might be aware of the risk, but I'm still not sure that that should exonerate, maybe the wrong word, but let them off the hook. On the back of the baseball ticket, or at least the contract that comes with it when you download it, says holder recognizes that attendance of holder and minors at the event is voluntary and may result in personal injury, including death and or property damage, and agrees to stay alert and remain aware of his or her surroundings and the surroundings of minors. By using this ticket or by attending, observing, or participating in the event, the holder acknowledges and assumes all risks and dangers associated with holder and or minors being a spectator before, during, and after a baseball game or other event, including warm-ups, practices, pre-event, post-event, between-innings activities, promotions, competitions. It goes on and on and on. It's pretty clear. Even I can understand some of that, that I'm saying it's on me, it's not on you. But it almost makes it sound like, because if you pay attention, a 9-year-old girl will be able to catch or dodge a 110-mile-an-hour foul ball. I think I made this point yesterday. I don't know if you agree. You're a Cubs fan. You go to the games all the time. If you told everybody, okay, Section 222, here comes a 100-mile-an-hour foul ball, ready? People would still get injured.
No question.
Sometimes they're not paying attention. Even if they are, I don't think that enables them to avoid it.
You're 100% right. And if you, there's a great piece on HBO Real Sports from a couple of years ago where Brian Gumbel did a study. They actually had people behind glass to avoid them getting hit, but they did a study of balls being, you know, coming out in the stands as if they were hit by a bat. And they showed people who were on their phones, people who were eating, and people who were actually looking right at the ball. The latter group, the people who were looking at the right at the ball, got hit the same degree. Because to your point, the attention, I mean, you can't catch that ball. It comes out so fast. So yes, you're right. There is that risk. But again, courts have consistently and recently upheld this idea that baseball is a carved out exception to the idea that you can sue owners of property for these, you know, negligent acts.
Baseball's come faster these days too, I think.
Absolutely.
I mean, I wonder, I know there's such a thing as precedent, but maybe the circumstances have changed. And again, if the netting goes up, this is all moot. But it's not up now. It's, you know, I put it this way. I don't blame the family for being angry. And it's not like Almora's a bad guy or even the Astros are a bad organization. But I don't blame them for going, we've been injured at no fault of our own and we should have recourse in civil court.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that the idea of going after a baseball club or Major League Baseball shouldn't be any different when you look at it practically than going after anyone else who causes an injury. For a lot of reasons, though, the courts have carved out this exception, and it goes further. There are some states, like Illinois, that have actually enacted legislation beyond the courts to codify the baseball rule, to give baseball clubs even greater protection. So, you know, unless the courts change the way they've done things, and you mentioned precedent, the precedent is clearly set that you cannot successfully win damages against these owners.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to change.
Well, football teams, hockey teams, basketball teams all play fewer games and have less opportunity for injury. Maybe if I were being considerate about this, I'd say you'd bankrupt a baseball team that plays 162 games. I mean, think the 162 games is probably 163 instances of baseball screaming into the stands and maybe injuring somebody. So we've got to grant them some special protection organizationally. They couldn't withstand the onslaught if they were sued every time a ball went into the stands. I understand that. But wow, that little girl didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question these injuries are very difficult. I think most studies have shown that there are about 1,700 people roughly per year that get injured in some way.
Really?
That's a lot. There's been about 2,000 deaths overall in the course of baseball. That's, what, over 100 years. Not an insignificant number, but the defenders of baseball will tell you that's a very, you know, very small sum and not a significant enough number to warrant changing the baseball rule.
Some texts and some phone calls. You ready, Rich Lenkoff?
Absolutely.
630, let's be honest, most of these people getting hit are on their phone. A, I don't agree with that. B, I still don't think that changes my argument. What do you say about that?
Yeah, again, I mean, if you looked at this study, and most studies, they show that being on your phone, of course, is more distracting. But even if you were standing there looking directly at the game, the time that you have to avoid that is minimal. So you can't avoid it anyway.
630 says, my heart goes out to that little girl, but Almora was not aiming for her. He was heartbroken. The parents and everyone should pay attention at the game. Is that relevant here? Is what baseball is saying is it's the parents' responsibility?
Well, that's the idea of contributory fault. I mean, that is a concept that would apply anywhere else but the baseball rule. You know, if this happened at a hotel pool and a child got injured because the parents weren't paying attention, of course they would bear some of the legal responsibility for that. Again, in baseball, because I'll just repeat what I've said, the courts have carved out an exception for baseball clubs. They enjoy almost absolute immunity to those kind of arguments.
Let's talk to Michael. You're on WGN Radio. What do you want to say? You're on the air, Mike.
Hey, afternoon, John.
Hey.
You know, it's a shame it happened, but I put the full blame on the parents. They shouldn't be taking a two-year-old kid to a ball game anyway because they really don't fully understand what's going on or can pay attention enough, let alone the parents paying attention to allow this to happen.
I was sitting at the Cubs game the other day.
Attention.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I was sitting next to some parents the other day at the Cubs game, and they had an infant. The kid wasn't 2 years old. The kid probably wasn't 1 year old. And they didn't pay any attention to the baseball game. It was all about having the baby at the game, and they were taking pictures of the baby at the game, and they were all adorable. And they watched a little of the game, but they were more vulnerable in that situation.
Listen, if today you go to a game and the nets, you know, you're in the area of the stands where the nets aren't covered, and right now that only goes into the dugout, then you are assuming the risk just legally and according to the document that you inherently sign, whether you like it or not, whether you read it or not, you are assuming the risk of balls coming into the stands, period. And I say period because, again, it's been very decisive. The courts have uniformly upheld this over and over again. There's been a couple of lawsuits that have actually gone farther than the trial court. So the appellate courts have considered this, and the mentality might be shifting, right? But as of today, uniformly, the baseball rule still exists.
Rich Lankoff's here. He's an attorney, can you tell? He's also a podcaster at WGNradio.com. Listen for Legal Face-Off. Let's take a break. You can call or text. We'll read more of your text. You can call right now, 312-981-7200. This family, and I hope we all are clear about this, these people didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not saying anything wrong about them acquiring the services of an attorney. I'd have one, too. But I'm wondering, then, what's the point of having an attorney, Rich, if you're saying it's that ironclad? We'll pick up the conversation here in a minute. Rich Lankoff is in our studio. You listen to Legal Face-Off. It's a lot of topics, a lot of information. It's very good. This podcast is with Tina Martini. When do you guys post the podcast? When does it go up, usually?
Every 2 weeks. We post our latest one on, Monday of this week. We had Kim Goldman on, among others. She is Ron Goldman's sister, podcasting as well about OJ. So very interesting discussion there.
BDL Law Firm. BDL Firm. BDLfirm.com is your website. So what do you make, then, of this family? Like, what's the purpose of having an attorney if you have no recourse against the organization? We're talking about the ball Albert Almora hit that went into the stands and injured that girl in Houston. They have an attorney. He's put out a statement this week saying that she had skull fractures and brain injuries. What's an attorney going to do for him?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the attorney knows, obviously, what I know, which is what we all know, that this baseball rule will prevent the lawsuit from going very far. I imagine the attorney will try to settle their claim and try to get something out of the Cubs, maybe, as you mentioned earlier.
Or the Astros.
The medical bills.
I think it would be the Astros, yeah.
Yeah, the medical bills. Certainly the Cubs are aware of the brand reputation that this affects, so might want to get rid of it. But ultimately, sure, if I was the Cubs counsel, I would say we sympathize, or the Astros counsel, I would say we sympathize, but our liability isn't there.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you normally represent the companies in these cases.
Sure.
And so would you offer them a settlement because dismissing them or fighting it in court just looks bad for the brand?
Just depends. I mean, my clients will frequently take a hard line on paying anything when they feel there's no liability because even though having your name in the press in a lawsuit is damaging, what could be equally or more damaging is having your name associated with frivolous lawsuits or one where you don't have liability. So, you know, that really depends. A lot of clients will say, we don't want to go through the time and expense and notoriety of litigation. On the other hand, they don't want to pay anything if they don't have liability.
Hey, Doug, you're on WGN.
Yes, Joe, and I was just kind of wondering, when the teams go over to the London area to play in Britain, how is this baseball rule going to affect them over there?
Yeah, good question. Ultimately, the clubs would still be sued on U.S. turf and face the same limitations on liability. If someone gets hurt, I would still try to sue the stadium, for example. They're not subject to U.S. law. So, as you know, there are multiple defendants usually. You know, usually plaintiffs are suing everybody to try to, you know, get as many people to contribute as possible. Huh. So if I got hurt in London, I would certainly sue the owner of the stadium because they don't enjoy the same protections that this baseball rule affords American companies.
Good call.
Really, really great question.
Good question. Thank you. John, I almost got hit by a ball at the Cubs-Brewers game, and I was paying attention. The ball travels so fast. 847 says, is risk and stadium liability for NHL the same as MLB?
Different. Baseball rule, and I'm using
only
the term,
baseball.
Only applies to baseball. Now, there have been similar limitations applied to other venues. It's not like you can successfully sue other sports. They also have some of the same limitations, but the baseball rule is this hard and fast rule. There was an incident a couple of years ago in Nashville where a girl got killed and they put up netting. So that has had some effects.
Once the net goes up, hopefully this whole conversation goes away.
Yes.
You're probably, I mean, wouldn't you advise your teams to put up the damn net?
Oh, of course. I mean, baseball, I think going pole to pole is the way to go. I think the minimal effect it has on the fan experience is outweighed by the safety benefits.
Nice to see you, Rich. We'll listen for your next podcast or the one that you guys just put up at WGNRadio.com with Tina Martini. It's called Legal Face Off. His law firm, Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, is at BDLfirm.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Steve, I am...
News is over.
Shocked and saddened by the story about what happened at the Red Line. I'm almost surprised I don't hear that more often. Your cell phone falls onto the tracks. You think, oh, it's right there. I can get it. I didn't see it. I didn't know this story. You just reported it.
Yeah, she apparently climbed down to track level to get it and was hit by a northbound train.
So let that be a lesson to us all. I'm so sorry to hear that story. That's just crazy. Walter Jacobs in our studio. I want to talk a little bit about the Democratic presidential debate last night. It was the first of two. 10 Democratic presidential candidates. No, not Democratic. Democrat. 10 Democrat presidential candidates debated on MSNBC last night. And then 10 more, including the big three Bs, Biden, Bernie, and Buttigieg, debate tonight. Last night, three were women. That's a first. Three spoke in both Spanish and English. None mentioned Joe Biden. Elizabeth Warren got most of the speaking time. Team Trump called it boring. Vogue, of all places, said it wasn't a snore fest, but it wasn't a food fight. They were asked at the very end by Matt Lauer to name, and they he said like just one word.
No, not Matt Lauer.
Was Matt Lauer?
Lauer's not with NBC.
It was, I can see him with his crew cut. Chuck Todd. Was that Chuck Todd? Yeah.
Might have been, yeah.
Chuck Todd. And he said, okay, name the geopolitical threat, the biggest geopolitical threat. Think about that. I don't want a paragraph. I want a word. What is the biggest geopolitical threat facing the United States? And here are their answers.
Well, the biggest geopolitical challenge is China, but the biggest geopolitical threat remains nuclear weapons.
Totally get it. Go ahead, Governor Inslee.
The biggest threat to the security of the United States is Donald Trump. And there's no question.
Congresswoman Gabbard, greatest geopolitical threat.
The greatest threat that we face is the fact that we are at a greater risk of nuclear war today than ever before in history.
Senator
Klobuchar. Two threats, economic threat, China, but our major threat right now is what's going on in the Mideast with Iran if we don't get
slimmer than what we've been going here. One or two words.
Our existential threat is climate change. We have to confront it before it's too late.
Senator Warner.
Climate change.
Yeah. Senator Booker.
Nuclear proliferation and climate change.
Secretary Castro.
Say China and climate change.
Congressman Ryan.
China, without a question, they're wiping us around the world economically.
And Mr. Mayor.
Russia because they're trying to undermine our democracy, and they've been doing a pretty damn good job of it, and we need to stop them.
I don't know if you heard Elizabeth Warren, in case you're wondering what she said. She said climate change. Personally, I would say the biggest, the thing that I would most ask my government to address today would be climate change. But if you said what's the biggest geopolitical threat, I don't know how it's not North Korea or Iran. China and Russia are economic threats. They're election threats. But I also think those nations are somewhat civilized. I don't think they will do the crazy things that Iran or North Korea might. So geopolitical threat, I would say North Korea or Iran. The thing I most want my government to address maybe going forward would be climate change. Walter Jacobson, you are in the studio. I did not watch the whole debate last night. I watched snippets.
I don't think you missed an awful lot. There wasn't a huge amount said, certainly not much said that was different one between the other. The last thing you read, you said, was that you talking or were you still quoting Ellen Warren?
That's me.
That's you. Okay, well, you made more sense than some of them did, I think. But there wasn't, as I say, much difference. Almost all of them, as you could tell from your from the running of what they said,
yeah,
to really put China up there high. But you could just tell that they were thinking, what would everybody else say? So I will try to say something different. Or in some cases, I will try to say the same, because that seems to be the most popular idea at the moment.
Did anybody distinguish themselves in your mind?
Well, that's what all the talking heads were saying had to be done. That's what all the people who are in politics and the news media were saying had to be done. And I don't think anything happened that sends one above the other. I can't imagine, John, that people who are watching that haven't had their minds by now pretty well made up. They just had to decide how rough to be on Trump. They just had to decide what kinds of issues would attract the people who were listening.
Did they take a lot of shots at the president?
Not as many as I expected. Or wait, I myself didn't expect too many. But all the common talk was that's what they would do. Because each one of them has to demonstrate to the Democratic Party that he or she will be tough enough to overcome Trump.
They didn't go after Biden much last night.
No,
now, he wasn't there, but he's the front runner. Maybe they will more tonight.
Yeah, they probably will a little bit more, but I think they're kind of timid about that because Joe Biden is a man who is so gentle and loved by so many people. They don't want to be in a position of having to tear him apart, which might work against them.
What did you think of three of them speaking in Spanish?
I was very surprised, but I have to say mixed. Pleasantly surprised because I think it's about time that was done. Unpleasantly surprised because it seemed so much like they were catering to the listeners. But, you know, it's a time when they should do that, so I give them credit for it. And those that could do it better than the others, I think, ought to get credit for that.
Yeah, that's it. If you're going to do that, you better get it right. Right? You better be fluent.
You're right. I wondered about that as they were speaking. I know a little bit of Spanish, but not enough to determine whether they were making any sense.
Well, I've heard some people handicap it afterwards, and generally they were good, but I've heard some from commentators that said, I had to chuckle the way they put a phrase or two. They didn't speak at great length in Spanish,
right,
but
right.
What they were doing was trying to demonstrate their bona fides. I am with the Hispanic community. I can relate to you, and here's proof I'm fluent in your native tongue.
That's good.
It's a little theatrical for me. I mean, it's a little showy, but yeah, I guess if you can make that point, go ahead and do it.
You'd have to say, or I would have to say, yes, definitely showy, but definitely necessary and a good idea.
The reporting today, too, Walter, is that you could see, at least by half of the presidential candidates, how far left-leaning the Democratic Party is. Did you get that feeling, too?
Yes, they were leaning to get a position left of center as far as they could go, because that seems to be the issue that is most prominent among and between the Democrats. That's going to be the issue between now and the Democratic convention.
Immigration, you mean?
No,
how far left they can go.
How far progressive.
But was there and then their progressiveness, I think, is demonstrated in their take, say, on forgiving college debt or helping resolve this immigration issue in a way that's more Democrat than Republican.
Right.
Were there some other issues where you went, wow, the left is controlling the party?
No, I didn't hear that. I was looking for that, and I didn't, because I think they were cautious enough not to get into a position like that. You know, John, the thing that really struck me the most by all this is being sure, and I can't imagine this isn't true, that Donald Trump, by that time, by the time it was over, had seen most of it. If not, he certainly will have had it taped and will go over it very carefully. What struck me about that was that Donald Trump is going to have a hell of a time beating some of these people on the issues. They are very articulate. They are very knowledgeable with huge amounts of statistics and data and feeling. Trump can beat them all if he is Trump. Beat him up. He can't beat the one up who's running against him, say, if the one running against him performs the way that person did or those people did last night, which should just quote effusively from statistics, history books, current events. And Trump can't deal with that. If they stay calm and they just repeat what they know, say what they know, I don't know how Trump could beat it.
Well, he did last time with Hillary Clinton. Elizabeth Warren is good that way, though. The book on Elizabeth Warren is that she's got passion and politics and statistics behind her, and she's very fluent in all of those categories. But I just wonder if, okay, so she might beat him up factually, and she might quote-unquote win a debate, and then he'll just be Trump, and a certain element will show up and vote for him.
Yes, I think that's true, and he will count on that. Whether he can pull it off that way, I'm not sure. But you know who's going to decide all this, of course, is the media, not the candidates, because the media is what determines what the people see. So it's the headlines, and it's the four or five words on television rather than any substance.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I forget where I was reading recently, but it was in one of these books I'm reading about the election that just happened and Donald Trump's presidency. And they said one of the things Trump knows is that it's not so much what they're saying on MSNBC or Fox News as much as it is the words that are scrolling along the bottom.
Yeah, that's
because so many people have the TV on in the office or in the lobby at the Jiffy Lube, and you're all sitting there and the volume's down. So Trump instinctively knew that it is critical who's controlling that scroll. And so then he's counseling his staff or the network heads or maybe somebody at Fox. Hey, you've got to put it this way because what those words are really matter. Forget what the video's literally saying. What we're reading is really critical. And think about that. How often do you say, oh, I heard about that, when all you did was read a screen scroll on TV?
You're absolutely right. I sit in the office here and watch the scrolling to see what they say, and I try to listen to what they're saying, and then I revert to the scrolling because I can't hear it because I'm working.
So if Trump did a good job, but then they say Trump acts crazy, you know, that's the opinion of the person that was typing the scroll, but it might not be the truth.
Does the average viewer know that? If the average viewer sees Trump being Trump, which we know him to be tough and a bully, and if that's what they see and that's what they like, then they'll continue to support him. If that bothers them, then maybe they won't.
We got some phone calls for Walter Jacobson, legendary newsman whose voice you hear Thursday mornings on WGN Radio, and once in a while he's kind enough to pop in here. Bob, you're on WGN. What can we do for you?
Hi, good afternoon, John Walter. I find it offensive that they spoke to an American audience in Spanish. If I would have turned it on when they were speaking Spanish at that moment, I don't understand what they're saying. If they want to go to a Hispanic community, by all means, let me know how great they could speak my native language.
I just thought
it was out of place.
No. There may have been only 100 people or two or even three listening last night there, but there were millions who were watching it on television.
That's exactly what I mean. Well, I don't understand Spanish.
But they only spoke in Spanish for at most 20 seconds.
I don't care. Well, three of them did.
Yeah.
Okay, so but your point is that rather than us coming down to speak Spanish at their level, better they up their game and speak English at our level, right?
No, they're running for president of the United States and should speak in the native language of this country.
Okay, we got your message. I'll let Walter get the last word in.
All the more reason to appreciate that they're speaking in Spanish, because the president of the United States has to, if possible, be familiar with those foreign languages.
Elif, where do we go next? To a break or to the call? Take a break. We'll take another call and read some more texts. Walter Jacobson's here. Did you watch the debate last night? Of course you didn't. But Walter did. All right. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN. Walter Jacobson watched 10 last night. You going to watch 10 this night?
I sure am. I want to see how Biden does. It's very important to know where he stands with those others. They have to direct their arrows toward him because he's on top. So, sure, I'm going to watch as much of it. Now, I shouldn't say as much as I can. I'm going to watch all of it.
All hold two hours last night, two hours tonight.
Yeah, and then they go on and on and on after that with all the talking heads saying everything I heard them say for 2 hours before.
John, to keep the candidates' answers unique, you said that they're all sort of playing off of each other. They should have them write them down on a board and lock in their answers like they do on a TV game show, and then they'd be stuck with that instead of manipulating it or going on at great length. Okay, that's an interesting idea. I'm not as bothered by that as I am when they just go too long. I also would like to see a little more interplay. And you do get some of that, and you had some of that last night when Beto O'Rourke was taking shots. They gave him a chance to sort of chime in whether or not it was his turn. What did you think of the format last night, Walter? Was it okay with 10 people?
Yeah, it was a little more difficult than with fewer people, but I thought it was all right. The problem with letting them go back and forth with each other is then they start talking over each other and you get absolutely zero out of it. I don't know how they could with 10 people. I don't know how they could time it so that a person gets to talk longer.
I guess you could do four debates with five people. You can't do one with 20. Two with 10 is stretching it.
Right.
I think at the end of the day, like, they know this isn't perfect, and it will be very difficult for the bottom tier guys to rise up, but everybody gets a turn.
That's right.
And it's at the end of the day, I think what you're doing is you're watching Cory Booker, you're watching Kamala Harris, you're watching, you know, Elizabeth Warren, maybe you're watching Amy Klobuchar. She's sort of hanging in the weeds there. Maybe she's going to make a move, but she's not a front runner right now, not by any stretch. I lived in Minnesota for 8 years and came to know Amy Klobuchar's politics pretty well. She's the U.S. Senator from there. She was along with Al Franken until he stepped down, and she does very well. Even as she pointed out last night, she said, I've had more success in red districts than any of these people. That is, she's in a blue state, a purple state, Minnesota, but it certainly has its conservative pockets. There's lots of Republicans who exert a lot of influence in Minnesota, and she says, I win in those districts.
Yeah.
So maybe we should pay more attention to her. Did you see I wonder if when you watch this too, Walter, you think, I'm looking for a vice president as much as a president, right? Like, maybe it's going to be Joe. Or maybe it's going to be Bernie or Elizabeth, but who would be somebody best to pair them with?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Good question, but I didn't pay any attention to that part of it because they kept my interest by talking about what was going on today, and that's a long way down the road. But I think we could know, certainly from history and what we know about what's going on in politics today, that they will have to make that, each will have to make the ticket somewhat varied, you know.
Yeah, right.
A black and a woman and a white, and maybe even Hispanic. The Hispanic guy, former Secretary of Housing, what's his name?
He and his brother are both very famous politicians,
right.
And their name is skipping me. I'll get it for you in a second. Anyway, you thought Julian Castro.
Yes, Julian Castro. He was very good, articulate.
I think he moved up the most.
I think, but that depends on where you're coming from when you watch it. You know, everybody's watches it with a certain perspective. I'm a television reporter and anchor man and radio, and I can't help but watch how the moderators and the hosts were working and who was asking fair questions and who was
did you think it was
answers.
A fair debate?
Yeah, I thought they did very well.
I got 18 seconds left. You asked us off the air, and I think now I can ask on the air. Maybe not. Producer Olive, do you know what the ratings were for the debate last night?
15.3 million views, John, down 4.3% since the first Democratic debate in October 2015.
All right, so apples to apples, fewer viewers last night than the first Democratic debate last time. All right. Let's do this again tomorrow, Walter. Why don't you watch the debate tonight? Then we don't have to, and then you can tell us what you thought of it tomorrow. Are you around tomorrow?
Well, I'm not, and I've got a very busy day, but I'll try.
If you can join us on the phone or in studio, we'll do that. If not, maybe we'll do it Saturday or Friday of Monday of next week.
Great.
Walter Jacobson is great. You hear him Thursday mornings on the Steve Cochran Show, and once in a while here. Thanks for stopping by.
Oh, thank you. I always love to be asked.
You just heard the beep at 3. We're on Rokan's clock now.
It's all right.
My clock's broken. It's been broken for 30 years.
Which is kind of terrifying, yeah. But yeah. Roe's driving the bus, everybody.
Thank you.
Actually, Roe's not. I don't know that I would consider you the driver of
the
bus.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. I'm the screaming, hysterical passenger.
Yes.
That somehow has commandeered the bus because they're just doing whatever I'm asking them to do because I'm nuts.
You just got on the L, and Roe's the guy down there on the one end, and everybody is sitting on the other end of the car. That's the vehicle.
Hey, I want to sing a song. I love those guys who get out and decide they want to sing for you.
Yeah.
That's really it. That's quite a moment. The CTA is quite a cultural experience. All right, listen.
Yes,
coming
sir.
Up on the program, I want to tell Steve Bertrand is going to be here to try to explain our trip to London.
What?
Yeah. We're going to lead right with that because
that's right. You're taking the trip to London.
Yes.
You going to the baseball game? Football game? What are you going to?
We're going to a football game.
Football game. Oh, God, that's right.
Yeah.
And I won't ask any more about it.
Right, exactly. And so, but he's because we've had to promote it in such an awkward way, Steve's like, hey, can I come in there and explain to you exactly what we're doing here?
Good idea.
Yeah, and it's better. It's really better that way. So he's
when's he coming on?
Just right now, after the top of the hour. Ben Bradley will be here. Then Bert Odelson, the great election attorney, will explain what happened today in the Supreme Court and why, as it turns out, the president, he's all mad about this question on the census.
Yeah.
But it's that he should really, if he's smart, he will just step away from this because it's a ticking time bomb because that case has changed. And he may not want to get in the way of it because there was some bad behavior on behalf of people in the White House. So he might want to step away. But you know what? That's never stopped him before. He likes to just go right at it.
You're a mystery man, Ro. I'm going to be listening.
Thank you very much.